Most weight loss programs are short-term fixes, but managing your weight needs a long-term solution. And that's what makes Noom different. Noom uses science and personalization to help you manage your weight for the long term. Their psychology-based approach helps you build better habits and behaviors that are easier to maintain. The best part? You decide how Noom fits into your life, not the other way around. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com to sign up for your trial today.
All right, everybody, before we get started with this episode of Benched with Bubba, if you love the strategy of season-long fantasy sports and live for the short-term gratifications of DFS, then you have to try out Weekly Fantasy Sports WFS on Owner's Box. Head on over to rotoballer.com/box and sign up today. Weekly Fantasy Sports is the best of daily and season-long. It keeps you engaged through live drafting and new multi-week games. Owner's Box will also be paying out users who bring their friends on board. Watch the real money rewards pile up through their first ever three-tiered referral system. Add friends, create groups, and rank up to elevate the trash talk and competition to the next level. But that's not it. Owner's Box will be matching your first-time deposit of up to $500 for any depositors through January 4th. Just head on over to www.rotoballer.com/box and sign up today to claim your $500 bonus and join the new wave of weekly fantasy sports. Now, to this episode of Benched with Bubba. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Bubba and the Bat Flip, episode 66. We've basically wrapped up our positional previews, not going to discuss last week. We're going to wait on the relievers, given Liam Hendricks found a home. I think we already projected him to be pretty high up the rankings. That wasn't the one I was most worried about compared to others, so we'll see. But first off, you can check me out on Twitter at BDentric, and my co-host is always on this endeavor, on Twitter at BatFlipCrazy. Toby, how we doing, man?
We're doing all right, Bubba. We're just plugging along. You know, for those of you who are joining the stream, it's been a little while since I shaved. So other than that, you know, just keeping on, having about a draft. I'm trying to keep a draft going, like, at all times, you know, just to pique my interest. So that's happening right now. And we're going to be going head-to-head. We're going to be going head-to-head soon in the Battle of the Pods. So that's exciting.
Unlike the Rotosaurus guys, they have to team up. We decided to take our challenge each other on this event.
Yeah. I
take two spots up out of the 15. So, you know, they had to team up, get it. They were worried to face this whole podcast league. Fun, but it's listeners' mailbag, as we talked about. And we got over 20 questions. And we'll start off with the first one from our buddy at BreakingBen_T. He says, seeing as this would be your relief pitcher preview, and I haven't started my prep yet, how many teams would you guys say currently have an obvious closer? So if you're looking at the chart, Toby, who do you think has an obvious closer?
Ooh, man. Obvious closers is a tough one. Well, we know one with Liam Hendricks with the White Sox. I think that is pretty clear. One of the resources and tools that I often use is Greg Jewett has a great closers thing, which I'm actually not seeing as the pinned tweet. Oh no, it's just a different link than I'm used to. It's not right here in front of me. All right, let's just. It's not a ton of guys that have it. Why don't you handle this one first, Bubba?
Yeah, when I look at it, I'm just scrolling through. I use Greg's deal. I also use Roster Resource as a relief pitcher guide, and it's really like six or seven teams. And you scroll through here, the Yankees with Chapman, that's going to be a locked-in deal unless Chapman gets hurt again. So he should be good to go. Obviously, the White Sox with Liam Hendricks, he should be the go-to guy there. Even though Bummer's very good, he's going to be the guy for now. The Angels trading for Rafael Iglesias, he should get the lead role, one would imagine. And then when you go to the National League, it's pretty crazy. Like, the Mets should be Edwin Diaz for now. It should be the go-to guy there. And then Craig Kimbrell should have the job in Chicago for now. That's a guy that gets talked about quite a bit recently. He should be the go-to. And then other than that, you know, you could say Kenley Jansen, but there's a real reality that Gratterall or Trinan or someone could sneak in there. You got Pomeranz for the Padres. That's up for grabs. So it's really just like four or five teams right now that you could confidently say has a closer.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think there's a couple ways to approach it, like in your drafts. I mean, number one, you can go after the guys that seem like they're a sure thing, you know, which is always something you can do, you know, put in that draft capital to make sure you get a closer that, that you feel like is set in stone, or at least has a little bit of, you know, a little bit of cushion there. But I actually kind of like it. I mean, I think that, you know, as somebody who doesn't invest a lot in closers up front, I think there's an opportunity, depending on the type of league that you're in, to take advantage of some of these situations where there isn't a clear guy. And it could be that you're spending two later round draft picks trying to get the two guys that you anticipate are going to be part of a committee or who have the best shot. But, you know, and that's kind of generally how I approach it. Like, one of the few guys that I've been getting a lot of are Hector Neris, for instance. I got my Phillies hat on. And I like Hector Neris a lot. He was the closer towards the end of last season. He seemed to straighten things out a little bit after a rocky early season. And, you know, and I think there's some, I also like to get guys that kind of have not necessarily clear backups, but cheaper backups. So like in a draft and hold, his name's Connor, I think Brogdon or something like that, like who pitched really well for them. So he's kind of a later round guy. Chris Martin is another example. Like Chris Martin with the Braves, it looks like it's going to be a Will Smith, Chris Martin combo, but Chris Martin's going like 200 picks later. So I think it's actually an opportunity more so than a challenge. I mean, it is a challenge to get the saves, but I think it's also an opportunity, you know, to get some cheaper saves and not spend draft capital, but still have access to them. So
no, it's definitely the truth. There's a lot of, like, since I named off maybe five teams that are qualified to have a closer right now, like you said, that leaves a lot of draft capital for later. There's guys that really are worth looking into if you believe in their skills. Like, I still like Hunter Harvey a lot for Baltimore. I could have said he was their go-to guy. I would imagine he's their go-to guy, but we saw once he got injured, they had like six guys get saved. So who knows how they'll handle that. They could rotate with him and Tanner Scott, the lefty. I wouldn't be shocked. But like Tampa Bay's got Fairbanks, Nick Anderson, Diego Castillo. Wouldn't be shocked if they all got 10 plus saves. Really, I wouldn't. That's just the way they roll that bullpen out. You got Jordan Romano for Toronto. He should be the guy, but you've talked about Rafael Dolas before. Like, I'm not going to go through every team, but there's a lot of opportunities, like you're saying, of later round targets that you can definitely make some hay with in drafts. If you're doing draft champions, draft and holds, the best balls, all that good stuff, there's definite late round targets to be made. All right, let's go with our next question from ICV at El Varnero, or Neru. Can you please give a few players to target in the late rounds of a draft and hold? I noticed there isn't a lot of articles. I pointed him in a direction. He's happy with where he's going with the best ball exclusive with Brian Seymour. He's enjoying that. But who are some of your later round targets? I know you're in a ton of leagues. You have guys that listen to this podcast that are in league with you. But who are some of the guys you're looking at?
Yeah. You know what I'm going to do? You know, a lot of times we talk about the guys that we really like, but I'm actually going to go to my player shares and share just a little bit. So some of the guys that I've talked about previously, I know, like, from a pitching perspective, Stephen Brault of the Pirates, you know, he's in the rotation. He pitched really well towards the end of last season. There was some skill gains there. I think he's a really good option. I talked about Eric Lauer. One of the guys I don't think we've talked about because he's util yet is Miggy. Generally, I'm not a huge fan of Miggy. You know, I haven't had him in a number of years because I don't think the price really fell to the point where it should. But now he's going around a pick ADP of 400, and so it's not super late in a draft and hold. But I think Miggy had some of his best StatCast metrics from a batted ball quality perspective last year. It seemed like he made a little bit of a contact for power type of a switch, but like the exit velocity, the barrel rate, they were all the highest they've been in a number of years. And I think he should get virtually every day at bats. I believe it was a Mining the News article, but it could have just been something that I saw, an article that I saw on Twitter that AJ Hinch really wants to try him out at first base as well. So I think if he gets enough reps there where he can get some eligibility, that could be a really nice addition. But I think he can still hit for a decent batting average, maybe a little bit of pop in the middle of that order. You know, I think getting that after an ADP of 400 is a really, really nice way to go. Another pitcher that I haven't talked about is Reynaldo Lopez. You know, again, this is towards the very end of a draft and hold, but at the cost where he's going, there was an article this week as well about the White Sox and their new pitching coach who's been working with him on some mechanics that they think can get the velo back to where it's been previously. And also, I mean, this is the same person who worked with Lucas Giolito to kind of help him regain his form. So hopefully they can work on improving him there. You know, generally speaking, in draft and holds, I like to target pitching towards the end of drafts. Like, I go really heavy on pitching. Some guys that I am drafting kind of later on would be like Anthony Alford. He's on the Pirates. He's got a decent stolen basis. He looks to be starting for the Pirates right now, and they have more openings in their outfield now. So I really like him a lot, going pretty late. I know his teammate. I mean, one of the things that I think is nice about these later round picks is thinking about guys who are maybe not in ideal situations but are looking to get everyday at bat. So Eric Gonzalez is another example, third base source, shortstop eligibility. A guy who actually had some decent StatCast metrics as well. So there's at least that glimmer of hope in addition to the plate appearances that pop out at folks. Some other guys, Brian O'Grady with the Padres is a guy I have a number of shares of. He signed a major league deal with them, so it looks like he is going to be at least on the major league team. And he brings some power. He brings some speed coming over from the Rays. So, I mean, I think that's the general profile of guys towards the end of drafts that I'm looking at. It's kind of like a combination of maybe guys who aren't in great situations who can have access to playing time right away, or guys who might be able to step in if one guy gets injured and possibly fill a need on my team. So maybe it's that they're filling a power void. Maybe it's that they're filling some stolen bases or both. That's kind of the general type of profile in terms of hitters that I'm looking at later on. But the research tells us that, you know, that those later round hitters are less likely to hit, I think, than the pitchers are. So I generally try to focus on pitching late.
Yeah, some of the guys I'm looking at, and mine's more best ball centric than draft and hold. So if it doesn't help you, I apologize. But it's a similar concept, I think, when we're looking at later players. A couple guys I'm going for speed and upside in the outfield, Roman Quinn and Tim LeCastro from the Diamondbacks. Those are two guys I've been getting super late in drafts. We've seen them time and time again. When they get playing time, they can run. Might not be there right away, at least for Quinn, even though I believe he was projected to start for the Phillies earlier this season. So if those two guys get playing time, that's pretty big. A catcher I'm targeting a lot. I know no one really wants to talk about catchers, but if you're looking for a third or a fourth catcher for some reason late, Elias Diaz of the Rockies, I'm getting in like the 48th round and later. He's projected to start for the Rockies in the draft and holds where you get to set your lineup every week. I believe like your DCs are setting your lineup every week. You get to play them for those Coors weeks. Like that's a big pick for me late in a draft in those kind of formats. And then pitching is huge. And this is where it goes back to the relief pitcher question we just had. I was just looking at like a lot of my drafts right now. I've had a ton of Hector Neris late in drafts because he just sits around there. I have a lot of like either Jordan Romano or Josh Staumont. Staumont's, that was before Greg Holland obviously got signed to Kansas City, but I still like Staumont's profile. And then it's jumping on pitchers like Jay Happ. I know he hasn't signed yet. He's going to sign somewhere. He's going to get you innings late. He's going to fill in stuff for you. Danny Duffy is not pretty, but he makes 25 starts. He's going to get you like 15 pretty decent starts. Like guys like that, that you can use to fill in if injuries take place or whatnot, like two start weeks once here and there. I take advantage of that because they're not sexy players. That's why they fall so much. but they're going to be in the rotation unless they get hurt. And that's a big thing for me. So kind of those boring starting pitchers late, or those kind of relief pitcher chances we talked about, those would be the guys I'm kind of looking at later in the draft. All right. The next question we have here is from our buddy. Oh, I'm going to save that one for last because that's a fun question that doesn't involve fantasy baseball.
Wow, I'm excited.
Triple Play Fantasy asks, this is for you specifically, Toby. If you had a time machine and could go back a few days, would you draft Giancarlo Stanton again?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably not. So I drafted, for folks who on Twitter I just posted, I drafted Giancarlo Stanton for the first time ever. I think it was yesterday, I think, at pick 143 in a draft and hold. And, you know, it's not a bad pick. I mean, I was partially joking, but it's also just like one of those picks. I think I made the comparison of, I felt like exactly how Brian Cashman feels like every time he looks at his payroll and he's like, I'm spending $30 million on a home run hitting DH, essentially. And it's just that way because, you know, the fact of the matter is like I picked him at 143. So obviously, I mean, he's a huge value, quote unquote value. If you look at him on any projection system, like he's projected for 41 home runs, he's projected for over 100 RBI. You know, if he plays, he'll be successful. And it's not a draft pick that's going to hurt me that badly at 143. But it's just, I think, you know, it's kind of a roster construction dilemma, right? And I even had somebody reach out to me in my DMs who was like, wow, it was in the draft. It was like, wow, a Stanton pick. That was a real surprise. And it's more just like, you know, another guy I could have gotten there was like Brantley. You know, and you might be like, Brantley, Stanton? I mean, Stanton's got this huge ceiling, whatever. But the fact of the matter is as I build my team out, I could have gotten Kyle Schwarber, you know, in three rounds later. Is he on a per plate appearance basis as good as Stanton? No. But would I be surprised if they had similar stats at the end of the season? No, right? And so it's just like that power profile, the RBI, you know, those are available later on. Whereas Michael Brantley's 300, just lock it in for a 300 batting average, is something that I think a lot of teams could use, especially as you head into the later draft rounds of the draft, where those types of profiles either hurt you a little bit more or just aren't available. And so I was just a little bit bummed about that kind of decision-making process. Part of it was just let's get one share, you know, on one team. And so for that perspective, I'm not bummed out about it, but I probably won't do it again.
No, I get it. And that's like, there's a few things you said there that I think need to get kind of hammered home. Like that last part where I wanted like a share on one team. I get it. Like I literally was tweeting with Derek Rhodes and Michael Simeone about today. I took Cole. So I started a best ball with Cole Castillo, and I took Adalberto in round three. And they're like, oh, that's kind of crazy. I'm like, well, A, it's a points league. If he does steal the way he's going to steal, it's pretty good. And I'm like, and I want an Adalberto share because if he goes off, I want him somewhere on my roster. Like he's that risk we talk about. But the difference is that was round three. The thing that I like that you said the most is – he was where you picked Stanton was what, round 12 or 13, something like that.
I'm not good at math. I think it was round 10.
Yeah, something like that. It's not going to hurt you, like you said. It's not like one of your top picks where it could literally lose you the draft. You just have to approach your draft differently from now on, like you mentioned. And the ceiling for Stanton's huge. We've seen it time and time again. If we get a full season and he still plays 120 games or whatever, you're going to get your money's worth at that draft pick so you can replace them later on. And that's the context I think needs to get hammered home, like you were talking about. Chris Towers talked about today. I think he quote tweeted you and went on a thread about it, or he was talking about Stanton on Twitter as well. And he brought up a lot of good points of, you know, when you look at his per plate appearances, like you mentioned, you look at his projections, you look at all these different things. If he's healthy, which is always a big if with Stanton, he's still a very, very good ball player. Even last year in the little bit he was healthy, everything matched out. The Statcast numbers looked good. Everything was good. Just got to stay healthy. So at that point in the draft, it's fine. It's like we talk about. Everyone has a price, or that's not the right way to say it anymore. Everyone has a ADP that's worth taking a chance on. And you've kind of got to that threshold with him, and you can roll. So I got no problem with it. Like you said, I wouldn't do it every draft, but to kind of diversify the portfolio, it works out pretty well. All right. At NBiscardi17 asks, are you fading small sample of 2020? And this is a question we get a lot. I see it a lot on Twitter because it's kind of keeps going back and forth. If so, well, let's break this down. Are you fading the small sample of 2020? I think we kind of talked about it, but would you like to reiterate real quick?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've touched on it a few times, but I mean, generally speaking, I think you take it on an individual player by player basis. Like there are some guys that I'm not too worried about, you know, what their 2020 look like. You know, like I just got Alex Bregman in my last draft at a pick 53. You know, and it's kind of like he was injured. He started off slow. He got injured. He just never got going. I mean, when you look at the skills, he still hit for a ton of contact, still has great plate discipline. Maybe there's questions about the power, but just the volume that he puts in play, I think you can bank on pretty much 30 home runs from Bregman. You know, that's an example of a guy who had a rough season, who's fallen. I mean, maybe not that far, but 20 picks when you're falling from, you know, the second round into that area of the draft, you know, that's an example. But especially like, you know, maybe for hitters, but I think more so with pitchers, I'm a little bit more interested because I think, you know, an example that was being discussed on Twitter today was John Means, who I'm a fan of. And it's like, you know, Means had a 2 mile per hour increase on his fastball velocity. He struggled early on and he had some injury concerns. I believe he was also on the bereavement list. I think his somebody in his family passed away. And then he came back and he was absolutely lights out. You know, his in-zone contact rate overall was in the mid 70s. I mean, that's Lucas Giolito territory. That's like the only other guy who's got that level of in-zone contact because his fastball was just fit. You know, last month of the season was 15% swinging strike rate. I mean, we talked about him on an earlier podcast, but was just lights out. And he was helped out though by super low BABIP and a really high strand rate. And so those things aren't necessarily, those things will regress, right, over the course of a full season as well. But, you know, those types of skill changes, I think, are translatable from season to season, right? He was facing major league hitters who had had a chance to adjust, at least a month to adjust to hitting. And he was doing really well in a very good hitting division in the AL East. And so I don't see a reason why that can't necessarily translate. Now, that doesn't mean that the risks that are inherent in his profile don't continue to exist. But that level of skill is not something that any pitcher can achieve, right? You have to have certain tools. You have to have certain ability. And I think he has that. And so that's an example. Drew Smyly's another example where he put it together. So I'm looking for fundamental changes in the skills that can translate from season to season, velocity being one of those things, a new pitch being another thing, right? Similar to like spring training in some ways, in terms of the things that you pay attention to. So that's kind of how I'm tackling to 2020. Similarly, like you can't fake max exit velo, right? You can't fake those types of things. Certainly over a small sample, you can kind of finish at the higher end of your range maybe. But you have to be able to kind of look at that and figure out what you think is legit versus just small sample noise. So, and I think it's a case by case basis.
Yeah, no, that's the biggest thing. It's case by case. Like I always say, you got to take it with a grain of salt. Like you said, look into it. Some things are actually legit and repeatable. Like you said, some aren't. He's got a Moncada question here, and we talked about Moncada. Guys, we know that had COVID, that had issues with COVID, that said they had issues with COVID. That'll make us take things differently for 2020. So just kind of keep looking at Mining the News from Jeff Zimmerman. He keeps coming out with good things about guys that were working on things, that are working on things now, that can help us kind of differentiate how much of 2020 really mattered. Like, because I think we said it a long time ago, the beat writers didn't have access. We didn't know a lot of things going on like we usually do. Like how sick were guys? How tired were guys? How much of it was just a feel thing? Like the things we usually find out during a season, like after a game, we had no idea. Like we have no clue. So there's certain things you can follow, certain things you can't. I would not ever say throw the whole thing out. I've seen guys say I'm not even looking at 2020, and that's not the right way to do it either, because sadly these guys are a year older. So no matter what you think, their body's a year older. So the production is going to change. Like that's just the way it's going to go for the good or the bad. But I would not completely ignore 2020, that's for sure. He says, if so, who may you give a pass to or not either way? I love what Tucker did and see him as a possible elite while ignoring Moncada's season. So he likes using Tucker's info, ignoring Moncada. Any logic here? Who are you guys going to ignore or lean into with poor or great 2020s? So yeah, we agree. You can pick and choose based on what you look into, Tucker, Moncada, and whatnot. You mentioned Means. Is there anybody else you're kind of looking to fade or you like more based on their good or bad 2020?
I mean, I could go through the list and identify a bunch of different guys. I mean, there's just things like, I think it's all just about trying to figure out what do you think is the true talent level of this player and like, what is their 2021, you know, draft stuff. So like Jose Abreu, I believe everything that he did last year, right? I mean, like he was a really, really good hitter. But I also don't want to draft him at pick, you know, 36, right, where he's going right now. And so like Rafael Devers is another example of a guy. He's moving up now, but his ADP over the last month is 44, which for me as a young guy who continued to hit the ball with authority, he struggled with contact a little bit, but I think we can give him a little bit of a pass for 2020. So that's another example of a guy who, you know, I think is being faded compared to where he was going last year. That really shouldn't be. I haven't been willing to jump on some of the hotter pitching guys, you know, like Zach Plesac. You know, I like him. I think he showed some really good stuff, but you know, at the draft price that you need to pay for him right now, I'm not willing to go there. Similar with Corbin Burnes. Again, both pitchers that I like, but I just, you know, that seems to be a little high for me, which I could certainly be wrong on that. So I think there's a lot of different guys. I mean, some of the guys like Yuli Gurriel is a good example of a guy I love who like has fallen way back. I mean, not that far back, but you know, there's just so many boring veteran guys that I think Altuve is another example who's fallen way too far as well. So there's a ton of them, and I think I'm more interested in those guys than the guys who maybe, you know, made a jump last year that are up there. You know, Trent Grisham is, there's kind of like that group around 50, pick 50 to 55, where you have to pay a lot for guys who did really well last year. So those are just some examples. I think you could kind of go through the ADP and see them in each round.
Yeah, no, and I think hitters more so than pitchers, because the hot new toy in pitching, I need to see more there, where hitters, like you mentioned Altuve, I think he's a great guy. I've targeted him a ton already. I think there's a lot to potential to gain from where his draft price is. I've talked about Moncada a lot. I think his draft price is going way too low. Matt Chapman's another guy. He had the injury that we didn't know was as bad as it was, and all of a sudden he has surgery. He's supposed to be okay now. So that's another guy that's going super late compared to where he should go. Jack Flaherty's a pitcher we've talked about here that last year was a borderline turn guy in the 1-2 turn. Now he's more the 2-3 turn in drafts, and he just had a complete COVID season. That's the best way I can phrase it. So like you said, there's a lot of guys you can go through the list and kind of make your arguments here and there about some guys getting bumped, some guys like a pitcher that's going higher than I think he should go is Ian Anderson. I'm not going to go there. He got quite the bump, but there's other pitchers around him I'd rather trust. So it's like we're not giving you like a straight up here's a list of guys, but it's one of those, it goes back to the start of this whole question. It's kind of a case by case, and you go through there. There's a ton of them. I think there's more so guys like Toby mentioned that I'd rather take chances on that. I think a fun exercise is go look at 2020 ADP and compare it to this ADP and look at like the first three rounds and look where a bunch of those guys are going now. Like even JD Martinez, who struggled a lot, but you look at his second half, Statcast hard hit and all that was phenomenal back to what it was before. And he didn't have the video like he likes. He should hopefully get it back this year. He's like going in the fifth, sixth, seventh round in some drafts. That's another guy to take a look at. So little things like that to peek at as the draft season comes along. And I have a feeling a lot of those guys are going to creep up come March. So get them in now. They're going to creep up come March. Daniel Prepas asks, curious to hear your rookie hitter and spec closer ranks, top five each. He asked you this, and I know you're in some drafts with him right now. So curious about this, but do you have any rookie hitters that you're looking at? And then after we discuss that, we'll look at some closers.
Rookie hitters. No, I honestly like don't have any rookie hitters that I'm really that in on. I think this year is so difficult because, you know, we missed out on an entire season of minor leagues. And last year was just different with the way that they were handling prospects, moving them up and down. I mean, Joey Bart's a great example where you know, last year he gets an opportunity to play in the big leagues, and this year, you know, it sounds like he's going to go down to double A or triple A, right? AAA. Potentially for the full season, yeah. Right? So you don't necessarily often see those types of moves, and I think you're seeing them again. I mean, generally speaking, you know, the rookies just, they get the price either gets inflated if they're good or they drop down. I mean, I don't know if Nate Lowe, Nate Lowe. I don't know if Nate Lowe counts as a rookie anymore, but he's an example of a guy who I think has clear opportunity for full-time plate appearances, at least initially. Maybe he gets platooned after that, but you know, that's an example of a guy that I'm interested in. But again, like the price is getting pushed up really far, and the that Rangers situation is nice in the sense that it gives him full-time plate appearances, but it's not a great hitter's park, and it's not necessarily a great lineup. So that's one example of kind of, I guess, quote unquote, a rookie that I have access to. One guy that I have a lot on draft and holds is Garrett Crockett. Crochet. White Sox. He obviously is not going to be the closer with Liam Hendricks being signed, but you know, he's just a really high K guy, absolutely dominated when he came up. And so, you know, that's maybe a guy who could have, I mean, probably won't have access to saves, but at least maybe in as a kind of middle relief guy can get you some good ratios and some strikeouts. But Keegan Aiken, I have a number of shares of his, you know, so I just generally steer clear. I don't see a reason to invest heavily in rookies, especially this year. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing some guys. Oh, you know, Leody Taveras.
Yes.
He's not later on. I've been getting a bunch of him. What do I have? I have Taveras. I have I'll have him in 6 of 8 drafts after today, just because I think he's batting leadoff. He's got some pop. I think he's got some growth that he can make. He walks a decent amount. Stole 8 bases in whatever 150 plate appearances. There's no reason to hold back on the stolen bases. So I think, you know, I don't think like 15-30 is out of the question for him. The batting average is a little bit suspect, but he's a guy, but he's not going later on necessarily. And what was the second part of the question?
Well, let me get my rookie.
Yeah.
So like Lowe's guy I have on my list, Taveras, I was going to mention him as well. Those are two for sure. A guy I love that I talked about in the third base podcast is Ke'Bryan Hayes. That's a guy I'll be targeting a bunch. He's moving up in drafts, so he's not going late, but he's just asking for rookie hitters. So you have Hayes and you have Baum at third base. Baum also has first base eligibility. Both very good rookies to take a stab on if you need to. You know, you're going to have Kyle Tucker. You're going to have Randy Arozarena. Those are kind of gimmies, though, where they're going in drafts. The Taveras call would be probably one of my top rookies to look at there. Then it just comes down to, like, you have Mountcastle. I'm not in love with Mountcastle, but I get it later in drafts. If you want to take a chance on him, you could go that direction. There's not a lot else that I have circled at this time when it comes to rookies. The main ones are the Hayes, Lowe, and Taveras are 3 that I like a ton. Pitching wise, I'll probably stay away from. That's just not my thing. His second part of his question was speculative closers. We kind of talked about them earlier. Who are your top 5 speculative closers?
Yeah, there's a ton of those. Pierce Johnson is a guy I have a bunch of shares of so far. He's with the Padres, pitched super well end of last year. Obviously they don't have a closer right now. I mean, Pomerantz looks like he might be the closer, but you have Pomerantz, you have Pagan. But I mean, I think that the thing that I'm kind of looking for is no set closer. And like, what is the incentives that a team has for going with a different guy, right? So there's that. I love Phil Maton, Phil Maton of Cleveland. So he's another guy. I mean, obviously it looks like it's going to be Karinchak, but Maton was lights out end of last year. So he's a guy that I've been really interested in. I mentioned Chris Martin as a guy that I like a lot. You know, he's not that late, but he's like going around pick 400, and he seems to have a share of the job, at least. Connor Brogdon, I mentioned him. He's on the Phillies. Again, I think Neris is the closer there, but he pitched really, really well. He's actually a forecaster guy where I've gone a little into a little depth of the forecaster, but he's a guy who jumped out when I was looking over the forecaster really briefly there, as kind of another guy that is pretty interesting to me. So I think that's four guys that are, have kind of piqued my interest, and I'm definitely interested in having some shares of them in draft and holds. And I'm sure, Daniel, you will take it easy on me and not draft any of those guys in our draft that we're going through right now.
One of my favorite ones, I forgot to mention him earlier about later round picks, Red Sox, Derwinzen Hernandez, lefty, throws very hard. I could see him getting some saves if Matt Barnes scuffles again. That's an arm I could see getting some shots. His talent level is great. So he's a guy I've been grabbing in a lot of places. You mentioned Garrett Crochet. I think he's a phenomenal one as well. If something with Hendricks, or they want to go a lefty and Bummer's on around. You mentioned an Indian, but Nick Widgren, like Karinchak should be the guy, but there's already reports coming out that Nick Widgren is a good chance to jump in there. So that one's one that might be closer to happening at the moment. He's a guy that's quite interesting when taking a look at that. And then, like, when you look at Oakland, they say Jake Diekman, but JB Wendelken is a machine when it comes to fastball, to strikeouts. Diekman's a lefty. Wendelken could snap into some saves as a righty, so I don't mind him at all. Jonathan Hernandez in Texas. Leclerc should get the starts and saves. I like Jonathan Hernandez a ton in Texas. I think he's a better pitcher overall, period. So I think he runs into some as well. So those are some of the guys I've been targeting for now. There's a bunch you could look at. There's a lot of committee situations coming up, but those are the main guys that I would. And I guess I'll give a Giants one here. If Reyes Maranta is healthy, he should be the closer. I'm just going to say that one. So right now, reports are he's healthy. If he actually comes into spring, Reyes Maranta is one to go take a chance at. Like that one quite a bit. All right. The next question on the show is, I believe it's from Prepus again. Nope. It is from Zaddy Guerrero Jr. Who is your favorite hitter that had a sub-200 batting average, a 300 OBP, and a sub-300 OBP in 2020, minimum 100 plate appearances? Brian Reynolds, Evan White, Jock Jams, Calhoun, I believe that was Willie Calhoun, Nico Goodrum, Dalton Varsho, Tyler O'Neill, Shed Long, Omar Narvaez, Rougned Odor, Adele, Kingery, Renfro, Gary Sanchez. So out of that long
so
list.
So many of them.
Who's your favorite one?
If you went by the number of times I've drafted a player, it would probably be Varsho. I think Varsho is just we talked about him in the catcher's elbows. I mean, he has a chance to really blow up that position. He plays every day in the outfield, you're looking at, I think the projections would have him close to 20 stolen bases at that point from a catcher, So you're talking about Kiner Falefa type stuff with a little bit more power, theoretically. Again, he didn't do well in his first year. Outside of that, Brian Reynolds, I think there really wasn't anything in the profile for why Reynolds should have been so bad. I think there was actually some areas of improvement, like his barrel rate. And I think he's going to be in the middle of that Pirates lineup. I think he might steal a little bit, hit for high batting average, decent amount of power. So of the list that you mentioned, I think it would be Varsho and Reynolds that I am most interested in and who I have on the most number of my teams. I'm actually really sad. I was going to get Brian Reynolds in my draft that I'm in right now, and somebody took him a couple picks before me. Looking for that late batting average, it would have been beautiful, but was not meant to be.
Would have been beautiful. Varsho and Reynolds, I agree with those two for sure. The third guy that I would have put on this list, Evan White. I know we talked about him in the first base position. I haven't really drafted him yet because at that point in the draft, I already have three or maybe sometimes four first basemen because I've been a little more aggressive on them this year. I like Evan White. Not sure I want to have to use him every week right now. That's the thing. But I do believe there's a bounce back. We talked about the strikeout rates and the swinging strike rate and the contact rates. Everything last year was so far out of whack compared to what he did, yet his hard contact and everything was, it's like the quality of contact was still very good. So I believe there's, he's like a regression to the mean situation, and he'd still be like a 250 to 260 hitter with power And I think that's a lot better than what, you know, below 200 hitter we saw last year. So I think Evan White's a guy you can definitely target later in drafts if you're needing some first base or corner infield help. AOK underscore Tigers fan asks, draft strategy for hitters. If there's a run on a position in the draft, when do you decide to reach to make sure you get someone acceptable at the position versus sticking with your list and taking the next player on your list regardless of position? So when there's a run, Toby, when do you just decide to jump in on the run even though it's not technically the quote-unquote next guy up for you? Or do you just say, screw it, and I'll deal with it later?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the player and the position. Like a good example would be, you know, as you're building out your team, I mean, you should be thinking about the types of profiles that fit into your team at any given time during the, especially when you get later on. So we're talking later on in the drafts here, generally speaking, with the runs, you know, because if it's earlier on in the draft and there's a run on a position and you don't really like the next guy up, well, you might not like that next guy up, but okay, let's say that that's going to be the worst position that you have, right? Like, let's say there's a run on second base and you'd have to push up the next second baseman that you like the most to get him, to make sure you get him. I'd rather just wait on the position and maybe have that be my weakest position and reach ahead if there's a clearly other guys who are better than that player or fit my team a little bit better than that player. So I would say that generally speaking, but it really depends. I mean, like in my current draft right now, my catcher two spot was open. And I want a little bit more batting average help. And so I felt like, you know, Yadi Molina was an important guy for me to snag there, even though I think there's some fairly similar catchers maybe. So I don't know if I pushed him up a little bit. His ADP is like 288. I think I got him at 248. But I just like him. And I know that, you know, if he contributes like he's supposed to, if he hits his projections, then it'll be a plus pick. So it really just depends, I think, a lot. And I think what you should be thinking about maybe more a little bit is the types of profiles that you're going to need at the remaining positions on your team. So if you need batting average and you're late in drafts, then that's going to dictate you maybe being interested in certain hitters within each position. So like first base, it does not have a lot of high batting average guys late. So, you know, maybe I'm looking at Yuli Gurriel and I'm going to push him up to get him at first base, not necessarily because there aren't other first basemen available, but because that is the fairly unique profile, you know, that meets the needs of my team. So I don't know if I'm answering the question appropriately, but it's generally I don't react to those runs earlier on in drafts or even in the middle of the drafts. It's much more about both the position that the player plays and the profile that fits there and if I need that. So it's a little bit like a puzzle in that sense. And so I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, but hopefully that is helpful answer to your question.
Yeah, kind of the way I'd go about it, I guess to make it in terms that I understand as well is you'd use your dollar values. So I guess one way that he could look at it, if it's just looking like a sheet, is when they get to certain like tiers of dollar values and, you know, maybe he wanted to get X amount of dollars from a position here and there. And that'll relate to the stats you're looking for. Or I know a lot of some places still do rankings based on tiers. I don't do tier rankings, but the whole premise of tiers is to make sure you get guys in certain tiers. And so when like tier three is running low, you want to make sure you get one of tier three before it goes into tier four. So if that helps you stay focused on what your goals are, then tier rank. That's one reason they're there for it. It's not what I use anymore because like Toby said, it's more about knowing the player pool and what you need at each position, which relates to your stats and what's available down the line. Now, he used the Gurriel example. If you think you can get batting average from another outfield spot later that you can use, then you don't have to force it at first. But it's an example that if you need it at first, there's Gurriel. So it's more about knowing what's left. Like it's like playing blackjack and kind of having an idea of what cards are left in the deck. Where can I go? Or do I have to like hold here and get something? It's just kind of situations along those lines. I know I'm starting to babble now, but
are you counting cards? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, Bubba? I'm counting cards. Yes. That's why okay. I live in my little 3-bedroom house that I keep it under the radar. But yeah, it's more about knowing your personal situation. Don't reach just to reach, basically. Make sure it's the right thing to do. But I get it. Like at certain positions, like second base, we talk about late guys like Castro and stuff. But we've also mentioned how good like those top four guys are. So if you see a run where like those three guys go and there's one left, okay, like if you want to reach like a round on them, that's fine. But don't go reaching like four rounds on guys just to reach. Then you're losing your leverage, basically. So that's kind of what I'm trying to get at there.
Yeah, I think maybe here's a good way to describe it. Maybe the way that I think about it too is you're when you're in a draft, you're trying to draft the best team.
Yes.
The best team that gives you the best opportunity to win your league, whatever the settings are. Your role is not to draft the best player at each position, right? And so think about which group of players, which set of players from round one through the end of the draft is going to give you the best team and the best chance to win. And sometimes we get hyper-focused on individual positions and not, you know, getting a guy before this tier drop off, or getting a guy on that tier drop off, but does that guy fit the build of your team to make it the most the best team that it can be, or are you just drafting that guy so that you can be like, well, I didn't have a really crappy first base, right? So maybe that's what it boils down to. If that makes sense too, I don't know. It's a great question though.
No, it makes a lot of sense. Like don't force yourself to take the shiny new toy just because it's a shiny new toy. Make sure it actually fits your team to give you the best team. Like you could have a bunch of cool players like that are great, but if you get a bunch of risky players just because they had a great year last year, you might not have the best team because they could all hit the skids real quick. So, yeah, no, that's a great way to put it. Our buddy, Cody Mack, he asks, start a 4x4 league using advanced metrics and statistics. Which ones are you picking?
I mean, that would be a really boring league, Cody. Come on. I don't know. Like pitching, I just have the K-minus walk rate. So it'd be a one by one. K-minus walk rate and WRC plus. That sounds fun, right? Yeah, I mean, I think this is that. That's kind of like the tricky thing about this is a lot of times we want to like do have fantasy baseball. And I know this is just a fun question, but we want to have like fantasy baseball mirror real life, but it's not that fun, you know, like, right. I mean, you could just drill down and drill down and drill down until like the biggest basic skill. Right. But, really like, you know, I just, you know, yeah, I don't know what the 4x4 would be, but literally pitching would just be K minus walk rate. And, you know, and maybe ex woe bacon, you know, just to drill down on that hitting piece. And I don't know, the hitting would be like WRC plus and I don't know, WRC plus. That's it.
I was thinking ex woe bacon. You could do like a average exit velocity of your team or max exit velocity average of your team, something along those lines. You could do for fun if you wanted to take your expected home runs instead of actual home runs, because some guys would lose some, but some guys would gain some. So that could get interesting because you really, how do you draft that?
Just throw an X in front of whatever the metric
exactly.
is that you, I'd do X RBI, X runs, X home runs, X stolen bases, shout out to Forecaster and Baseball HQ, and then expected average. That would be what I would do.
You could have fun with like first pitch strikes, or actually one I'd like, instead of strikeouts, put away percentage. Mm. That's a fun one. But yeah, you can have all kinds of fun at the same time. You know how tough that would be to break that down for a draft. That would be something. Yeah. But yes, as Justin said, I love bacon, and so do I, Justin. And that's my XO bacon is like my favorite stat, I think, because it says bacon, and I like how it just discusses plays in contact. So it's a combination of things for my lazy brain. Dave Petroziello asks, I made a preliminary list on paper because I like to remember what it was like when I first started playing fantasy baseball of what players I like at their draft spots. How much would you emphasize getting players earlier at positions that you don't like as many players at, while obviously still weighing in value? In other words, maybe I would give up a smidge of value, but not too much. We kind of just discussed this. But how far are you usually willing to jump to get a player? Like, I think it's kind of more roundabout what he's talking about here. What's your willingness to jump? Like I said earlier, you know, don't jump like three or four rounds, but if it's like a round, okay, that works. What's your kind of jumping area?
I think it depends where in the draft you are, a lot. I mean, like from a position standpoint, like a good example is, you know, earlier on I found I was drafting like Ozzie Albies and I was drafting second baseman, but I actually really like some of the later values. Like I don't have any Jose Altuve at all, even though I really like him. It just hasn't worked out yet. But like, you know, like I like Tommy Edman a lot, you know, at second base, or, you know, I like Nick Solak a lot at second base, or I like, you know, Ketel Marte at second base. Right. So there's just like all these guys that I like later on in second base. And so in that particular sense, maybe I was like, nah, well, I don't really need to prioritize Ozzie Albies. I feel like I can get, you know, a pretty good second baseman that I feel like is a value that's good to me. I mean, one thing about jumping rounds, I think, is that earlier on, there's more differentiation in terms of values, right? So like maybe your round one guy is like, and I'm just making this up, is like a $30 player. And then your round two guy is a $25 player, right? So there's like a $5 valuation difference. And then your round three guy is a $20 player, you know, and then the next guy is a $15 player. So there's actually a fairly different, big difference in terms of value there. But when you're drafting around pick 150 or 180, the difference is like the difference between 150 and 180. I should actually just look at my valuation spreadsheet. So the number 150th player in my valuations is, drum roll please, the number 150th guy, as my thing spread things, is Michael Brantley. Wow, speak of the devil.
Yeah, that's speak of too Michael much Brantley. Right
there. It's actually Gene Segura, but Michael Brantley's on line 150 of my Excel, so we'll go with him. He's an $11 player at 150. And at 180, the guy, 180, it's Ramon Laureano. So he's 950. And Brantley is $11. So there's a $1.50 difference in valuation, right? If I go the difference between Laureano at 950 and say pick 225, you know, it's 653. So it's a few dollars. But I guess what I'm trying to say is when you look at those valuations, the difference literally is like three home runs, yeah, you know, or three stolen bases or 15 points in batting average. There becomes like a lot less of a difference from pick to pick between the players. Yeah. And I think at that point in time, I think it's all about, again, what is the best team that I can build? And I think when people say, go get your guys, you know, I think it's totally accurate in the sense that if you really like a guy and you think that he's better than his ADP, don't be afraid to jump. You know, don't be worried about jumping. If you think a guy is important to building the best team, then jump in there, you know, like just get that guy, because literally if you think that he's going to hit three more home runs than his projection currently is, then he's likely going to be worth that. Right. Or he's not value, but he's likely going to be worth that cost. Right. And that's just looking at it from a purely valuational perspective. There are some guys that, because of the way that they accumulate stats in different categories, may or may not be more or less valuable to you and your team construction. And so recognizing that and not necessarily looking at it in a myopic way, in a one dimensional way, but like it's a multidimensional puzzle that you're trying to put together. And so don't be afraid to get the piece that you need, even if it costs you a little bit more, if that's the piece you need, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. That's why I was the get your guy part, I think, is the important part there for me, because that's one thing we talk about a lot. And, you know, you get in your drafts, and our next question will kind of follow up with that as well. A lot of guys we draft with know us, and you know them. Like, you know who you're drafting with for the most part. Like, when we get the TGFBI, you're going to know most of the room, at least half the room. We do our Battle of the Podcast League. We know that entire room. So they know who we like. We know who they like. Go get your guys. You know, you're talking to Petrozello, the guy that asked the question. He's in NFBC leagues. A lot of these guys know their stuff very well. So they know if you're in on a guy, they're probably in on a guy too. or at least someone that's drafting after you before your next pick is going to be in on a guy. So be willing to go a round or two. That's fine. Don't go crazy. The other part to what you're saying, how the evaluations get closer and closer dollar-wise, I think it's like something we've talked about. Earlier on in drafts, you got more 4 to 5 category guys. Later in drafts, the evaluations, like you said, are 3 homers here, 3 stolen bases here, whatever. But the farther back you go, you're drafting needs for your team, not so much an all-around player. So you can kind of gauge things differently. Like, okay, I don't have to force myself here. I'll go get another power source in the outfield over here, so on and so forth. Like, there's little angles you can go off of based on the player pool that's left. So getting your guys, I think, is better than saying jump for value. That's where I would go. I'm with you there. Because the last example I'd give is you mentioned waiting for like Altuve's or whatever at second base. What I like to try to do, like you said, Edmund, is have like 3 guys you think are very similar to each other afterwards. And that's when you can kind of maybe think, okay, now I need to go get a guy. Like, and this isn't a top tier guy, this is a mid round guy. Okay, these guys are pretty close to each other. I want one of these 3. Because then the drop off to the next guy likes like 6 later. And I don't know if I want to wait that long to have to force my hand then. So it's kind of something like that when you're drafting that is the angle I would go off of. Zach Roto, the guy running our podcast league, does knowing your opponents well, i.e. Battle of the Pods, cheap promo starting on Friday, change anything up for draft strategy or KDS? Who do you want to draft next to? So you draft in these big NFBC leagues with a lot of guys that know you and you know them. How much does that affect you?
I really don't think about what other people are drafting or who else is drafting. The only way it comes across my mind is, yeah, if I know that a guy if I know that a player that I'm playing against is into a certain player and I'm also into a certain player, then that may impact the way that I draft them. Right. So, and I think, you know, and there's so many different variables, but generally speaking, I don't really pay attention to what other people in the draft room are doing, you know, because I'm, you know, and it's easier in a draft and hold to focus on like what else is happening just because you have more time. But I'm pretty much focused on trying to build the best team that I can in that draft space. And again, like, it's not that I'm going to ignore information. Like, you know, you're drafting 12th, I think, in our draft, and I'm drafting 14th. Yep. And so I know that you know the guys that I like, right? And I know the guys that you like.
Yep.
But, and so maybe I'm going to be like, well, Bubba's definitely going to take this guy in the next 2 times that it goes through him. So I need to draft this guy now or else I'm not going to get him and I need to figure out what I'm going to do. But there are maybe like 1 or 2 instances in the draft where something like that is going to happen. And generally speaking, you know, the only time I would contemplate hopping that is if I'm like, this is the guy that's available and I really need this profile. And this profile, I don't really see it anywhere else. And so I got to maybe jump the guy that I regularly would get in this instance because Bubba's there. But, you know, and it kind of gets to that idea that, like, you know, yeah, you share what you do as an analyst and people pay attention to it. But when you're in the draft room, guys want to draft their teams, right? And they're smart and they want to, you know, and they have the guys that they like and they may be the same as me. They may not be the same as me, but they're going to draft who they want to draft. They're not going to draft the guy because I think they're good, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I think like the other example is it might be more important in the middle of a draft when we're at the turn like this, worrying about what I'm doing when there's like 28 picks between your 2 picks or whatever. It's a lot different, like where I might have to worry about what you're doing because there's literally like 4 picks or 5 picks until my next one and you have 2 of them. So that gets interesting. But yeah, if you're sitting in the middle of a draft, like say you're pick 7, well, now you got to think this way or that way. You might have to go jump a pick early because you don't want to jump like, you'd be jumping almost 2 rounds basically to get your guy. And that's a little different than jumping the 1. But like you said, I did a bunch of listener leagues last year and I was getting sniped all over the place. And that's just one of those deals. They listen to the show. They know who I like. The thing we pride ourselves on, I know we talk about a lot, is knowing the player pool and having players you can pivot to. And that's just the way drafts go. You're never going to walk into a draft room, no matter who you're drafting with, if you know them all or don't know them all, and leave with every player you want. That's never going to happen. So you have to be able to adjust on the fly. And hey, maybe it's a little more challenging because they know who we like. That's part of the deal. And that's kind of part of the fun to me too. I like having to kind of think, hey, do I really want to take this guy here? Or can I wait and take this guy here? That's part of the fun of drafting. Like, can you still fill your team out here instead of just literally walking in and going, hey, I scripted this out and I know I'm going to get all these guys. I'm going to walk away now type thing. It's just not the way it's going to work. So roll with the punches. Richard Sands asks, three offensive players and three starting pitchers you're looking at after pick 500 for DCs and best balls. So give me three offensive guys after pick 500, Toby.
Three offensive guys after pick 500, huh?
Yep.
All right. I really don't draft a lot of guys after pick 500 who are on offense. Let's see what we got here. I mean, I mentioned Anthony Alford. I think just, you know, he has access to playing time. I think he's pretty good. Who else? Oh, another guy, Jason Vossler. He's with the Giants. You know, he actually has a pretty good projection. He's a kind of like an older minor leaguer who's hit really well. I want to say, did the Giants take him in the Rule 5 or did they sign him or trade for him?
I thought it was the Rule 5, but I honestly can't remember off the top of my head right now.
They gave up something to get him, which makes me think that they see something in him. So Vossler is another guy that I've been targeting later on. Gosh, it's so hard. I mean, literally, like, you know, I really don't draft a lot of hitters later on after pick 500. I'm trying to be accurate in providing you with good things, but I'm not seeing guys that I'm really taking. Maybe Pat Valaika. I think he's after pick 500.
He's
first base, second base, shortstop, and I think he may get some playing time, and he had some pretty good metrics.
Yeah, he's a guy I had circled. He played a lot towards the end of last year, and with shortstop opening up there in Baltimore, he might get the first run as well. So he's an interesting target. I mentioned Brendan Rodgers on the second base pod. If God forbid they ever had an opening for him, that would be a steal at pick 508. So he's an interesting one in those deeper leagues. If you want to take a chance there, I don't mind him. And there's Tim LeCastro at 543. I mentioned him earlier for a late round steals guy. Brandon Marsh of Anaheim is getting some buzz as a potential fourth outfielder that could squeeze in to a role for the Angels. He's a high end prospect for them. And then the last guy I'll mention, because you're, like you said, you're kind of just throwing darts here. I know you said three guys, but I want to give you this one more. I just had him circled. Where the heck did he go? Brett Gardner's falling like crazy. That's always interesting, but I just can't force myself to do that one. But Josh Jung of Texas, there's a chance he gets some third base work with if they do shift Andrus out of the way and move IKF over to shortstop. Josh Jung, the rookie, he would be a rookie because he's making his debut, but there's a good chance he could get some run this year for Texas. Would be a guy I wouldn't mind looking at. Do you have three pitchers you like after pick 500?
Yeah, I've mentioned a bunch of them already. One guy I haven't mentioned before, I mean, I've mentioned like Lauer and Suter and Vasquez and Reynaldo Lopez. So a bunch of them. One guy I haven't talked at all about that I'm into is Jeff Hoffman. Hoffman was traded. They traded Robert Stevenson, the Reds, for Hoffman. So clearly they see something in him. And when you look at him and when you think about Spincinnati, you know, and kind of the focus on spin, he's got a really high percentile, both fastball velocity and fastball spin. And so I think that that's really interesting because of what the Reds can do. And I think what they're looking for. And so he also has two pitches. I want to say, I think it's a changeup and a curve, that both have 15% swinging strike rate on them in addition to his fastball. So he's already got two decent offerings. Let me just confirm that. I'm just going to look that up, because what happens to me, as people who listen to the show probably know, is, you know, I look at a lot of these, I look at a lot of different metrics for pitchers, and then I remember guys being certain things, and then they end up not being, and then I look foolish. Yeah, So his four-seam only had a 5% swinging strike rate, but again, he's in Coors and he's got the velocity, he's got the spin. He's got a changeup that generates a 15.6% swinging strike rate and a curveball that generates a 12.5% swinging strike rate. And so for me, that's just a really interesting, I think that's a really interesting profile to be in there. The Reds are certainly looking to move some of the guys in their rotation, possibly Sonny Gray, which could open up an opportunity. And they also have Wade Miley in their rotation. So, you know, it's essentially an open spot there. But Jeff Hoffman is a guy that I haven't really mentioned before on any shows that I really like as well.
There's a bunch of guys back here. Like, I know we mentioned a bunch earlier. Darwinson Hernandez is back here after pick 600. That's a guy I've been targeting quite a bit. If you want to play the saves game, you got Jose Alvarado back here who could be splitting some time with Hector Neris. But starting pitcher-wise, Logan Webb, around pick 580, he'll be in the Giants rotation. I think he's a good best ball draft and hold type guy because we saw stretches of him being very, very good. And we saw some hiccups with him. There's a lot of volatility there, but when he's on, lots of strikeouts, pretty decent ratios too. So I think Logan Webb, and he should have a spot in the rotation unless something really crazy happens. So I don't mind him, but man, there's a lot of speculative closers back here. Wendelkin's back here. Our boy Vinny V's back here. This is why Toby said he pretty much takes pitchers late. Like, I'll sprinkle in some bats here and there, but you can make arguments in deeper situations. Like, okay, Alex Cobb is not a sexy name, but when you can decide when he pitches or they only take his best starts, basically, he's still going to give you 10 to 15 pretty good starts. And in a deep, deep league where you have no roster moves, he doesn't suck. Like, those are the kind of things that I like to take chances on later in drafts. Like, John Lester's back here at 650. Like, not great, but he's going to start pretty much every fifth day. He's going to sign somewhere and start every fifth day. So that's the kind of guys I'd look at. There's a bunch back here. Jose Urania just signed with the Tigers. I know that's a guy Toby's been on in the past. That's another guy to target. So lots of options back there as well.
Yes. Urania. I'm on the clock, Bubba, in my DC right now. Uh-oh. I am going to draft Nate Lowe.
There you go.
At pick 308.
I like it. Big Nate Lowe fan. So I'm with you there. Our boy Michael Simeone at SP Streamer, he asks, we just did our KDS for that podcast league that starts drafting on Friday. How do you have a KDS preference? Let's put it that way.
It's a great question. I really struggle with KDS this year because I think it's a fundamental question about how you want to build your team. Because I think if you draft on in the first half, I really want to get like a Cole, DeGrom, or Bieber probably. Although Bieber obviously with Cleveland, you know, showing, you know, not having as good of an offense, it's a little less intriguing, but I still think he's incredibly good as a pitcher. You know, I really want to get like a Cole or a DeGrom, but if I do that, I'm not going to like the starting pitchers that are coming around probably to go ace, but I do like the pitchers that will likely be available to me in rounds 4 and 5. And so it's different. So the KDS that I set in the first, you know, we have this baseball battle of the pods. It was, I think 5 was my first choice. 6 was my second choice. Then it was 4. And then I think it was 3, 2, 1. Then it was 14. Then it was 15. And then I think it was like 13, 12, 11, something like that. So essentially I think when I get closer to drafts, I'll probably just want one of the first 2 picks, honestly, just so that I can make sure that I get Cole or DeGrom. But if I don't get those guys, then being towards the back end of the draft. So again, you know, probably right now, like, it's so hard. It's so hard. There's just so many different ways to go. I'm not set in it in one way, but I do think that it's very different ways to build your team. I love the hitters that are available on the back half of the draft in rounds 3 and 4. Just to give you an example, I drafted 14 and I went Darvish, Giolito. And then the hitters that I got were Eloy. And this is actually it from 8. Eloy and Bregman in rounds 3 and 4 after going pocket aces, which I felt really good about. And you don't get a lot of speed, but I feel like there is some speed guys later on that you can kind of put together. So I just think it's a really tricky one. I haven't settled on anything, but I think when it comes down to it, when the main events happen in March, I will probably want Garrett Cole or Jacob DeGrom. And in that case, I might as well just put pick 1 or 2 because I'd rather, you know, the worst thing that could happen to you is be try to get cute and do like 3, 4 or something like that. And then what can happen in a main event draft is those starting pitchers go 1-2. So it'll all depend. But I don't think there's a bad place to be necessarily, except for if you're targeting a starting pitcher, being at like 9, 10, 11, where I think you're going to miss out on the top three, and then you're going to have to either push up like a Giolito or Darvish or Bauer, which you may not want to do, or, you know, or take a guy on offense, which, you know, if you're into offense, then that's not a problem at all. But I do like being in the middle of the draft too. So it's all over the place, as you can tell.
Yeah, I don't mind where I draft from per se. I'll figure it out from there. But like when I'm setting KDS right now, I kind of want to be at the front or the back. It's kind of my preference. So I pretty much do 1 through 4, and then I go from 15 and go backwards. That's pretty much my preference. I want one of the top picks to get hopefully one of the big arms or one of the bats I like a lot, or just put me in the back, and I'll double tap back there and go. So literally I do 1, 2, 3, 4, 15, 14, 13, just go backwards all the way. So that's why when I got picked 12, that was like my 9th preference. Like I never get one of my top preferences ever. It just never happens. I just laugh. I think I predicted it basically in our chat. I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to get, like, it's not like you, me, and one other guy, three of us, I think, are the only ones that didn't get one of our top three preferences. Yeah. Like someone said that. So,
and we'll finish top three in the, yes, the draft. I mean, exactly. When the season's over. So
yeah, that's all that matters. Our buddy at MS at SMMS 79 head to head. Do you consider Mondesi in pick 20 to 28 range because of his ability to almost give you a category on his own every week, or give me your top? Or okay, well, he has multiple questions. So in a head-to-head league where obviously it's a new slate every week, do you consider a guy like Mondesi to move up in the draft for you because he can win you a week, no problem?
No, I mean, I don't play head-to-head really, so I'm not good to answer this. So I'll make it very short, I promise. I probably would not draft a Mondesi type in head-to-head.
Yeah. I'll kind of add on to that. I would say no, and I'm a Mondesi fan here. Mondesi can win you one category. There are 5 categories. And if you want to, there's usually 5 hitting and 5 pitching. If he's winning you one but hurting you in the other 4, it's going to be tough to win those other 4 to help you win the week. That'd be the best way I could describe it for you. I love Mondesi, but he's more enticing to me in a point setup or a season long where you can struggle with him, but get the total package by the end and you're fine. So that's where I'd go there. Cause what'll happen is you'll get frustrated and you'll bench him the week he steals 6 bases. And then you'll really want to break something. So that's just how it's going to go.
And my understanding of head to head theory is kind of like you want consistent players more than kind of your up and down guys.
You would love it because if you get ace pitching like you like to do, that thrives there. That's a big deal.
Maybe I should join some head-to-head. Except the only problem is the whole playoff thing where it's like...
The playoffs suck.
Playoffs? Sucks. Playoffs?
And you don't need to join head-to-head. You're doing just fine where you are. Give me your top 5 to 10 inning pitch leaders for 2021 who will have surprising volume on your mind. Do you have a top 5 inning pitch projection? Or I guess you give them steamers or whatever. And
I mean, literally, you probably just go from the top, right?
The aces, yes. Yeah, they're drafted high.
Jacob DeGrom, Shane Bieber, Trevor Bauer, Hugh Darvish, probably Skip Bueller, Giolito, yeah. Nola, Nola's Castillo.
Like, if you want a later.
That seems like a pretty good.
If you want, like, a later guy, Kyle Hendricks always gets innings. He's a guy that he'll get you 180-plus.
Lance Lynn, you know, is going later, which will be – he'll be up there.
Or a guy we talked about, Sandy Alcantara. He's an innings machine. But, yeah, like you said, pretty much the top guys are the top guys because they pitch a lot.
Yeah.
The best way I could say it.
I think you can get volume later on too. I mean, I think that profile of like a Hendricks is a good example, you know, where it's like – I mean, I think like a guy like Keuchel, you know, can go pretty deep. You know, guys who are more efficient with their pitches – and generates a decent amount of contact are generally able to go later. So
yeah. That's an important question. Like if he is doing head to heads, like he's asking, cause you want to maximize your innings pitch. Cause a lot of those leagues have innings pitch limits. So that's something to keep in mind. You want to make sure you're getting your best bang for your buck. He also asked, he was thinking of trying to close out his infield minus catcher in the first 5 or so rounds. Is that going too far? Second base and shortstop are just so worrisome late. I wouldn't make a point. We talked about this many times. don't make it a point to have to fill out positions by a certain time. There's always, kind of goes back to what we talked about, there's always ways to find spots to fill with. And like, don't go crazy that early in the draft.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think you should go into it thinking I want to build my team in this way, but I also think that you want to build from the back forward. So recognizing where the guys you like later on in the draft are. And so if you find yourself, you know, like I often am, being very interested in the outfielders that are going later on, because there's a variety of them and they fit different needs within a roto context, then getting infield earlier on is certainly nice, but I wouldn't put a ton of pressure to do that. I think it's, again, try to build the best team that you can build using all of your roster spots, and don't be as fixated in a strategy like that.
No, I'm with you there. In our chat, we'll get a quick one here. David Cole Jr. asks, do you have any quick thoughts on Michael Kopech or Dylan Cease? I know I like them both, but Cease needs to figure out his control. And Kopech, I don't know how much they're going to let him go after the injury. That's my two biggest concerns. Great arms. They added some depth with veteran leaders with Lynn and company, but that's my two cents on them. Do you have any thoughts on Kopech or Cease?
Yeah, I'm more interested in Cease. The same article I mentioned before that about Renaldo Lopez and some of the changes he was doing. So Cease has one of the fastest fastballs in all of baseball. I think it's like 97.5 averages. But he doesn't have great spin. He cuts the ball. You know, Saris has talked about this before on Rates and Barrels and in other places. And so in that article, they talked about how the new, I think it's Eric Katz, I think is his name. The new White Sox pitching coach is working with him on improving that spin efficiency and getting him to cut the ball less, which I think could be huge for him. And so I'm really interested in him, especially the price isn't too high, the ADP isn't too high in the high threes right now. So I definitely think he's interesting. He's got the pedigree. He's got that fastball velo. He has the changeup, which we've heard is really good, but hasn't really shown it. He does have really terrible control. So, you know, that's always a risk, but I think there's opportunities there for him to be successful. Kopech, I just don't know. I haven't seen enough of him to really have developed a really strong opinion. There's obviously an injury history there, which is concerning. I think the White Sox relief corps too is really strong. I mean, they have Hendricks now. We talked about, is it Crochet or Crockett?
I always called him Crochet. I'm probably saying it wrong, but okay. I've always said Crochet.
Okay, so Crochet is good. Cody Hoyer, H-E-U-E-R. Was also really good towards the end of last year. Evan Marshall was good. Matt Foster was also really good. So they have a number of really high quality arms. You know, they won't have access to saves unless Hendricks gets hurt, I think. But from just a skills perspective, I think they're all really good. I actually think Aaron Bummer is the least skilled of all of them. Everybody seems to really like him as a future closer, but he never had the K rates and he's just not, he wouldn't have been my choice, but yeah.
Yeah. No, and I like the Cease call. He's a guy that he's shown life, because if he could ever lock in consistent command, he'd be scary good. It'd be great to see. Kyle McPadden asks, thoughts on Christian Walker? Can you repeat 2019? I've said it before on the first base preview and others. He's a guy I love to target late. His overall profile is great. His last year was much more of a doubles year than a home run year. That's minor tweakage type stuff. Like if he gets a minor tweak back to normal, he is definitely back to 2019, if not better. Like his average was better last year, more doubles, so many things you look at. It's one of those kind of Manny Machado stories. Just elevated a little more, doubles turn into homers, life is good again. I think Walker, especially where he's going in draft, I think he's fine, totally fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he's solid. I haven't really targeted him much in drafts. I do not have him on any of my teams, but I agree with Bubba in the sense that I think he's solid all around, should get everyday plate appearances. Makes a lot of contact for a guy who hits the ball pretty hard. Does need to elevate a little bit more, maybe to get maximize that pop. But so everything that Bubba mentioned, I think he adds a little bit of speed at first base too, which is always nice. So
he also asked, two hitters and two pitchers starting the season in the minors that will make their debut in 2021 that you believe strongly going forward. I'm not a major prospect guy. I can throw you some darts, but this might not be the best show to come to for that.
Yeah.
Like Brent Honeywell, but now he had surgery again. Forrest Whitley for the Astros. Good chance he gets a shot. So he'd be a guy I'd look at. But other than that, it's I'd say look at bad teams that might rotate through players. That'd be my best option there. When it comes to Tampa Bay, do they start the year with calling up their shortstop or not? I just totally blanked on the name.
Wander Franco.
Yeah, because obviously he's going to play eventually. So that's another guy. Does he start the year with them or not? It's time will tell on stuff like that.
Yeah, so one guy who I've been drafting towards the very end is Sherton Apostle, who's the Rangers. He's a first base prospect, has hit at every level, really good plate discipline as well, just kind of a masher. I think he got his debut. He played a few games at the end of last year. He's one guy hitter that I'd add to that who could be interesting just because I do think he has. He's hit at every stop. He's just a hitter. He's going to be a first baseman. He started out, I think, as a third baseman. He could be a DH, but he was actually on one of my dynasty teams like 3 years ago, and I traded him. So he's one guy that I would add to that list. But yeah, I don't know enough about the minor leagues right now. You know, like we just missed a year, and so it's just really hard to know who's on the cusp and who's not. But I do think Honeywell is a good shot. He did have that surgery, but I think it was minor from everything I've seen. There's obviously injuries there, but where he's going in drafts, he's very, very late. And he's got that pedigree, and we know that the Rays have some openings in that rotation. So,
yeah, there's him. There's also Josh Jung, mentioned him with Texas. He's going to get a spot eventually. He's got a very good bat. Andrew Vaughn was mentioned by David Cole. I think he starts the year with the team, but if not, he's a guy to definitely target as well to come up. There's a ton of them. I could literally go to one of Fantrax's, Eric Cross, or Clegg's pages. I can go to the Welsh's rankings or James Anderson's rankings. There's a ton of great prospect guys out there. I didn't even mention half of them probably. And the top 10 to 20 all probably have a good shot of playing sometime this season. So, and a lot of them have free content. So I'm not trying to take the easy way out. I'm just saying I'd recommend going to them and checking that out. The next question, as we're getting towards the end here, HJS561. If punting saves this year, who are your guys' favorite targets late? Also taking, so we already kind of hit on the relief pitcher stuff earlier on, so we'll kind of cross that one off. If you're taking three starting pitchers in the first three rounds, in what round would you start considering your fourth pitcher? Now, that's a great question for you. Because you're a pocket aces guy, and usually you wait till like the seventh or eighth round in the past. What are you doing? Say you take three in the first three. When do you think about taking a pitcher again?
If I drafted, I've never drafted three pitchers in a row to start a draft. If I were to do that, I would probably wait until pick 200-ish to draft my SP4.
Yeah, because if you got three aces, you're pretty much locked in. Like you're usually rotating the back end of your staff throughout the year anyways. So I'm not saying you never know. Maybe going earlier is great because you have four guys you don't have to worry about. I'd rather get those for sure bats at that point. I guess kind of where you're going as well. And you're kind of – you're not in a hole, but after waiting 45-plus picks for your first bat, you're in a bit of a hole. Like you're not in a – but you've missed out on some really good talent. Not that you can't make it up, but you got to really start crushing some hitters to catch up to things. So – I think you're right. It's a good guesstimate about pick 200 in that regard. Bill Petragak asks, with potential six-man rotations, innings limits, and COVID postponements, is this year to fade pitching and attack hitting?
Never.
I think it's more important to get the good pitchers, personally.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's always all relative, you know? Yeah. So it's like, Saves are harder to get. So yes, theoretically you don't need as many saves to get to finish high, but at the same time it's harder to get saves, and so it's harder to achieve that. Yeah, I agree with Bubba. I think more so than any time before getting that's part of the reason why I go with the pocket aces, or at least, you know, getting a lot of high end starting pitching early on this year. Is that those are the true differentiators. Those are the guys that you won't get guys later on in drafts that are able to replicate that often, right? There might be one guy every season who makes that jump, but it's really hard from both a volume perspective and just both the volume and the quality that you're getting. I mean, that's what makes them aces. And so I don't think it's the time to fade pitching. And that said, I mean, I think there's many ways to win, and it may not be the way that I'm most comfortable building a team, but certainly there are going to be some of those guys in the mid tier, maybe some of those guys that have fallen because of a poor 2020 that outproduce what we were expecting. And that can always happen. And you can, you know, for lack of a better, luck into that, right? Because I don't think that's something that's a skill that many people have, is consistently being able to identify later pitches that hit frequently. And if you do, I would love for you to reach out and kind of share your secret with me if you do that on a consistent basis, because I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, and that's why I've really bought into your kind of pocket aces deal. I don't go hardcore on the two, but I've mentioned, like, I want the full house. Give me three in the first five. Like, guys I can trust in to start, for the fact I want that stability. In years past, when I wasn't a big starting pitcher early guy, and I know a lot of people weren't, it's because more pitchers went deep into games. More pitchers were giving you this, that, and the other, which we don't get anymore. And I know on the recent Rates and Barrels, I think it was Rates and Barrels, one of the it was either that or the recent Deadpool podcast with Alex Fast. They were discussing, you know, as pitchers start pitching fewer and fewer innings, is, you know, the new is like the old 200 now 180, is 180, 160. Like, are we going to start settling for the lower amounts to make a difference type deal? And that kind of makes an interesting discussion on when you're drafting and why you draft those guys that are going to give you 180 to 200 innings over those other guys right there. It makes a big difference, like you're talking about. All right. Paul D from Long Island. It's like a radio call. Longtime listener, NFBC player, big fan of the show. Question for the mailbag. Given the growing trend of teams using multiple relievers to close, how many relievers will you roster in DCs? Do the ADPs of known commodity – okay, we'll start with that. How many would you roster in a DC with all those questions up in the air?
Relievers.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a particular number that I hit. There's more like a group of players that I'm after. So I would say I generally want two guys that I think are definitely going to be the closers. So just looking at the draft that I have right now, I drafted Jordan Hicks and Hector Neris. Again, you know, maybe it's 75% chance that they're closers to start the season, or maybe even 50. But, and then I want to maybe back that up a little bit. So maybe I'll go after Connor Bogdan later on, because I think that he pitched really well last year and the Phillies don't have a lot of stuff. And I know that some people think Jose Alvarado is going to close, but I just don't see that happening, just because of the inconsistency and also because he's a lefty and, you know, all of those reasons. I'm not sure how many lefties they have in that bullpen. So, so that's like maybe an example. And then I'll get maybe Chris Martin, you know, if he's available, or Jake Diekman, something like that, like a guy who seems like he maybe has it. So maybe I have three of those guys to begin with. And then I want to get as many high-skilled relievers that I think may be in a position to get that. So, you know, I mentioned a bunch of them before, like Pierce Johnson, Phil Maton, Connor Bogdan, maybe a few more. So I guess maybe like eight. I generally want to have like 24 pitchers, I think, 24, 25 pitchers. And I'd say probably eight of those are relief pitchers, maybe. I don't know, 8 to 10. But it really just depends on which one of them I'm able to get.
Yeah, I guess the more important part is have the guys you like. Don't force your hand to get X amount of closers. I think that's a good point there. Do the ADPs of known commodity closers like Hendricks and Hader already reflect their premium value as locks for 20-plus saves? Thanks, keep up the good work. So I would say yes. The guys that are going higher are more locked into roles, and they actually have a better skill set, better talent level. I think once, like a lot of these guys later you mentioned, if we start finding out they're the go-to guys, they're going to go up in the draft also. So that's why we didn't even do a – that's what we talked about. We're doing a mailbag this week, so the relief pitcher preview, because there's so many guys. Literally, we started out the podcast, first question, how many teams have locked-in closers? It was like four or five, it felt like. It's tough to do a podcast to tell you what closers that are good to draft. We don't even know who's actually the closer yet. So that's where it's tricky.
Yeah, for sure. And I think with the cost, it's going to be very interesting to see how the market values closers, because I think heading into 2020, we had the exact same conversation. Like, we were in DCs around this time and closers were going really late. And then the closer you get to the season, they start to trickle up. You know, they start to move up as we get more information, and maybe the jobs seem to crystallize a little bit more in certain positions. And then it's like you have the top end of that closing, those closers, and they get pushed up because people feel like there's certainty. And so then you'd assume that maybe the other guys don't push up. But what ends up happening is people start to not necessarily panic. I don't mean this in like a pejorative way, like you're doing something wrong, you panic. But what happens is those guys are gone and people start looking at their team and they say, where are my saves coming from? And then you start to look at the next bunch and you're like, you start to order them and you start to say, well, I think this guy is 85% and this guy is 75% and this guy is 65%. Not that exactly, but I think that's the psychologically what happens to you. And then that ends up moving those guys up, because then that 85% guy becomes the next closer that goes. And then the next guy becomes the 75%. And the further back in the draft you get, the less confident you are that guy's going to be your closer, and you still feel like you need to get a closer. And so what ends up happening is when we're making our drafts in March, our big drafts in March, they're always pushed up. And it's going to be fascinating, because I think starting pitching is already pushed up to such a high extent. It's going to be so interesting to see how, with relief pitching not being pushed up so far, what's going to happen when that gets pushed up, and just how everything kind of settles in 2021 as we get more information. I think it's going to be really fascinating to see. And I think you're going to see it with Hendricks. I think Hendricks is going to start to be that fourth round in a 15-team league closer that starts to go, right? Instead of going around pick 68 or whatever it's going to be, you know, he's going to be top 60, you know, or top 60. Yeah.
Now they're going to start moving. The other thing is there's a ton of guys that are going to close that aren't even signed yet. It's not even like it's just good relievers. There's just closers that aren't signed yet. So it, like, literally we thought maybe Bummer was going to get a shot, or they're going to re-sign Colomé. They wouldn't sign Hendricks. So it's just, you don't know what's going on right now. So time will tell. Like you said, come March, a lot clearer stuff, hopefully. All right.
Time will tell. Great song by Bob Marley. I would highly recommend people go and listen to that. Great song.
Well, and after you listen to that, our last question of the night from Dave Mendelson: pancakes, waffles, or French toast?
So, as this is an easy question, it's pancakes by a landslide.
Why?
It's not even close. Generally speaking, I would say ricotta pancakes. Ricotta pancakes are
really good. You're going fancy. You're not going like regular.
Nice and fluffy. I mean, regular is fine. Regular is fine. Regular is great. But ricotta pancakes are absolutely delicious. I mean, pancakes are so multidimensional. You lather them with butter. You throw like a bunch of maple syrup on them. You get like whatever type of like fruit you throw on there. You can put like bananas in them. I actually have a really good pancake recipe. It's a three ingredient pancake recipe. It's like a healthy pancake recipe. Cause I'm one of those people. It's just oatmeal. Well, it's not really technically three ingredients, but it's oatmeal, bananas, oatmeal, bananas, and eggs. The basic is two eggs, one cup of oatmeal, two bananas, and then there's also baking powder, cinnamon, and vanilla, and salt. But you just mix that up, and it's really good. It's absolutely delicious, and it's healthy. Justin, it is a pancake. It is a pancake, and it's delicious. I don't want to hear it.
It sounds more like a fancy dessert pancake, like a crepe. That's why when I think pancake, I think like you get the regular, just basic buttermilk pancake with a thing of butter and syrup. Like, if you want to get fancy, then let's talk French toast. Like, that's where the fancy is. You get some powdered sugar on there, get all the fruits you want, you get the different syrups like chocolate and, you know, caramel or maple syrup. You got all kinds of goodies there. Literally, you go to the sundae shop, guy that likes desserts as much as you do, French toast is right in your wheelhouse.
I mean, let's be honest. Let's be honest about French toast for a second. We don't like French toast. We like the toppings that we put on top of French toast.
Well, what's the difference than the pancake? Like,
oh, the pancake.
Cinnamon, vanilla.
The texture. Banana. The taste.
You can get fluffy French toast.
What you put inside of it, you know? I mean, French toast. I mean, I like a good stuffed French toast, you know, like anybody else. There was this, when I lived in Seattle, there's a place called Portage Bay, and they make lemon curd French toast. So it's like a lemon, like drizzle with blueberries and whipped cream and all that jazz and maple syrup and butter and the whole thing. And that's absolutely delicious. But I think when we break it down to the essentials, I mean, I think pancakes win the day. I mean, when you put the right amount of butter and maple syrup on a pancake, the texture is phenomenal. I mean, the way that, like, you just, when you cut into it, it's like you can already taste the deliciousness before you even put it in your mouth.
It sounds like you have to have the right butter or syrup. If you give me a regular pancake and a regular French toast, I'll take the regular French toast all day long without putting anything on top of it. Like, if we're just comparing apples to apples.
Here's some bread cooked in eggs. Mmm.
Fluffy.
That was delicious. I can't believe that we're not even talking about waffles. I mean,
waffles is the lazy way to save syrup.
I mean, waffles,
like, you have to something fill up to be every, said about fill up every square, right? Like,
yes, with the syrup. Yes, you have to. Totally. You do the lines every square. Like this. To fill up every square. Of course. But there is something to be said for their ability to capture, you know, ingredients inside the waffle square parts, you know, that can make it really good. When I lived in Boston, I used to go to this, this is when you start to make fun of me more, but there was this place that made vegan waffles.
I don't make fun of you.
There was this place that had vegan waffles. It was called, it used to be a music joint as well. It's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's in Harvard Square. And I'm totally blanking on the name, but it was absolutely fantastic. Absolutely delicious. Every week. Justin,
he's loving it.
Something I understand. Justin Mason is in the comments making fun of vegan waffles. And all I gotta say is, Justin, that's all I gotta say.
Well, I was gonna ask more stuff, but I think we're going to have some bad rabbit holes in a minute. So I might save them for a future podcast, because I think we discussed last week, we can talk desserts or whatever food all day long. So that's not an issue. That's why this could take a turn into something else. So I'm gonna wrap it up there. Okay. I think we've hit over Fair 20 enough. Questions. Justin Mason's gonna go full troll mode in a minute if we stay in here any longer. So we gotta watch out. It's below the Mendoza. Oh my God! Yeah, we gotta stop.
I must say, Justin and family are incredible dessert makers.
That's why I was gonna go into the Pazookies, but I think I want to save that till next week.
No, you got to share the Pazookies. You can't mention them and just not.
No, well, it's called the cliffhanger and a tease, Toby. We talk about them next week on the show.
Okay,
that's what
they're just gonna be in the chat next.
That's up to him. That's on him. That okay. We know his wife will let him go because he always tell her he's doing something else. So he'll join the show there. But that keeps people coming back, because if we talk about Pazookies now, we won't get off the show until midnight. Okay. So we're going to call it there. Next week, we'll see what we're going to do. But homemade waffles are what you get. There we go. But check out Toby on Twitter at BatFlipCrazy, his podcast at BatFlipCrazy. I am on Twitter at BDintric. You can check out the Bench with Bubba podcast, of course. We both have our YouTube channels, so go like all that good stuff, subscribe there. And otherwise, we'll be back with you guys next week with more fantasy baseball analysis, some dessert talk. Who knows? You bring the questions. We'll talk about it. Toby's a big music guy. I like TV and movies. Toby likes TV too. Like, we open book, people. Open book.
Multi-dimensional. If you think about us as fantasy baseball podcasts, we are like your multi-position eligible players.
There you go.
We cover the entire infield.
We are the Kiki Hernandezes of the league.
We are. I mean, he's only got dual position eligibility. He's second base and outfield too. I mean,
true.
Let's let's go with like a Tommy Edman,
you know, Pat Valakis. We're late rounders.
We're Pat Valakis.
We're the late rounders. Yeah, so we'll talk about all that. We'll have all the goodies there, but check us out next week, and good luck. Keep the questions coming, and we'll have more fun like this, but good luck. Toby on Twitter, again, Batflip Crazy. I'm Matt Biedentrick. Bubba and Batflip 66 in the books. Catch you guys later.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.